Welcome to Pushback, a social justice podcast produced and distributed by Philadelphia Magazine and Word Radio. Thanks for downloading Pushback. This is Flood the Drummer.
And this is Malcolm Burnley.
And you're in for a treat. Today on this episode, we're having an intimate conversation with Larry Krasner. He's the Democratic nominee for District Attorney of Philadelphia. Malcolm, I'm pretty excited about this conversation.
Absolutely. I think one of the big questions is kind of where did Larry come from? I mean, we know he's been a lawyer in the city for all these years, but I don't really know too much about his backstory and prior to researching this. And I think just kind of what makes him tick. He's obviously been described as a gadfly. He's been described as all these things in terms of fighting against the system. But like, where does that come from for him? I mean, he's a, what, 56-year-old white guy?
Mm-hmm.
He could have probably made boatloads of money. He's got a Stanford.
He's already made boatloads of money.
yeah. I guess they're not mutually exclusive, right? I mean, I really want to get into both his past as well as kind of recap a little bit about this heated DA's primary.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that Larry has been around for a very long time. I don't know if you're aware, but when Wilson Good, of course, the first black mayor, came in, he called Larry to come in and deal with ACT UP and the protest that was happening at the Bellevue. Of course, he defended Occupy Philly, the Philly 10, Black Lives Matter. But these are all stories that people already know about Larry. Even the cohort of lawyers he put together prior to the DNC to defend protesters. So these are all stories
and
that get
RNC
a lot of press.
Too.
And the RNC. So yeah, Larry gets a lot of press, but there's also a lot of things people just don't know about him, like his childhood, who he is, and more importantly, what informs his sense of justice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really interested because grew up in St. Louis, and that's also where my dad grew up. And I'm really interested because they're roughly the same age. My dad's a little bit older, but St. Louis is a really segregated city. And we all know, in terms of what happened with Ferguson, that kind of boiled over just outside St. Louis a few years ago. But St. Louis is definitely not exactly this bastion of liberalism. So the fact that he came from there originally, and I think both of his parents maybe were from there, I think that's a really interesting fact. And just how he got to Philadelphia and also how that's informed him being from the Midwest.
So what do you think about in terms of expectations, the fact that Larry is coming into office and succeeding a person who's in jail? And I can't wait to talk to him about this. But do you think that the public has now a lower expectation of the person who's going to go into the office or a higher expectation?
I think it has to be pretty high, right?
Really?
I mean, I do. I mean, all the hype, right? I mean,
okay,
all the publicity that Larry has gotten, that he's also ridden, and combined with, the infusion of cash from, not directly to his campaign, but of course with the PAC from George Soros over, $1.4 million?
Mm-hmm. And George Soros is a wealthy New York billionaire. He founded the Open Societies Foundation. And when we talk about George Soros, he got painted a little bit unfair in this campaign race because
Soros or Krasner?
Soros, okay. Because Soros has donated to a lot of different causes, and this has just happened to be one of them, right? And so I was just trying to get people to see, Soros isn't the devil,
right?
You know what I mean?
Right.
But I think there is something to be said about PAC money and how much money influences these elections.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there definitely is, and anytime you have kind of the most progressive, or essentially the most, but a lot of progressive coalitions in the city supporting a candidate for district attorney, it's just such a unique and basically topsy-turvy idea, right? That someone who has no prosecutorial experience, who's basically defended his clients to keep them out of jail his whole life, is now going to be in that office. So I think maybe if not expectations, at the very least, there's a lot of anticipation because a lot of people aren't sure exactly what the office is going to look like. If there's going to be this great exodus of assistant DAs, I think there's a lot of anticipation.
Well, I'm anticipating this interview, and I think that and other times usually we could talk,
Zing.
But this is one of those ones I really want to get to. So Larry Krasner, welcome to the show. So, Larry, when we started the intro, we were talking about the fact that you're going to be succeeding an individual who's now in jail, and that people might have an even higher expectation of whoever takes over that office. You're likely going to be the next district attorney in Philadelphia. So my first question to you is, what keeps you honest? And given that the fact that the 1.5 million people that live here likely will never meet you, the majority of them, why should they trust you?
Well, what keeps you honest is not lying, cheating, and stealing. I think everybody kind of knows that.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't actually be considered a challenge not to take a free $46,000 roof, not to take a free custom sofa, not to have 50 trips to other people's houses and get a free Jaguar.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I've been blessed in a way that nobody ever wanted to give me those things. So I'm not used to it.
Okay.
So that to me is not such a challenge. Why should they trust me? Well, you know, I've always thought respect is earned. And the reality is they're not going to trust me when I first come in there any more than they would trust somebody else they've never met. But I have to earn that trust and I have to prove that on the job.
Mm. So let's get into your backstory a little bit. So my dad grew up in St. Louis. He's a few years older than you, but I've had a lot of familiarity with the city. And so my dad's described when he was growing up there, at least the neighborhoods he was in were pretty segregated at the time. So tell us a little bit about, I don't know if you grew up in St. Louis or just outside, but what was your neighborhood like? And then I was hoping maybe you could transition and talk a little bit about like what your experience was with criminal justice growing up.
Sure. So I was in St. Louis from the time I was born in 61 until about 68, 69 when our family moved out here. I lived at 6640 Crest Avenue, which is, as I understand it, considered a university city in St. Louis. And I used to walk up the street to the Pershing, like General Pershing Elementary School, top of the hill. My experience in that school and in that neighborhood was that it was actually pretty diverse, that I had a lot of classmates who were non-white. But, you know, I was 8 years old. I mean, I can't give you any sort of wiser insight than that. And it was a long time ago. And I'm surprised that anybody older than me is alive. So my best to your dad.
So you don't consider yourself a Midwesterner, probably?
I mean, both of my parents were born in the Midwest. I had a ton of relatives out there. So I consider myself a lot of things. But one of those things is Midwesterner.
Okay, fair enough.
Your mother is or was religious,
right? Yes.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about her.
So my mother graduated high school at 16. Her father at that point was essentially a pinto bean farmer. He had been a Model A, Model T mechanic. He had done a number of things, and her whole side of the family was basically farming folks outside of St. Louis in the Troy, Missouri area, not actually all that far from Ferguson, although she had been born in Colorado, and then they moved out. But she graduated high school at 16. Her father had been a wild man who became born again. And so she grew up in a religious household. Even until his death, her father would do things like help rebuild churches that were burnt down, that sort of thing. Comes out at 16, and she became a tent preacher, as they say in Philly. I guess in the Midwest, they probably say a tent evangelist. Mm-hmm. But she became a tent preacher. And, of course, you know, that means no microphones. That means the wind is blowing through. That means you're traveling around, and there's a tent full
of
people.
You were with her in the tent? Growing up?
No, not at all. This happened, I mean, my parents both had kids a little bit later in life, like a lot of people who grew up in the Depression and then went through the war. You know, they were settling down and having kids later. But this is when she's 16 years old.
Okay.
She's come out. She's a tent preacher. She goes to God's Bible College, and then she went to Asbury Theological Seminary in Kentucky. Originally intending to be a Methodist, she actually came out being a Nazarene. It turns out not the easiest time for a woman to become a minister in, you know, in the Protestant Christian Church in the United States. You know, she was born in 1922. So we're talking about a whole different generation. But that was her thing, and she was a faithful person to the end of her life. My father, on the other hand, was of Russian Jewish heritage. His parents were off the boat, and he was born in 1917, so he would have been 100 today, died 13, 14 years ago. Very different. Secular Jewish family, kind of political. He came out of public high school where Tennessee Williams was actually a student right behind him. In St. Louis, came out of Soldan High School in St. Louis, and then he was a letter carrier for 6 years. His father was a man from Russia with really no formal education to speak of, who spoke four languages and read in four languages. So he worked as a letter carrier. There was no option of college. Pearl Harbor happened. He volunteered for Pearl Harbor 7 days later. Served in the Pacific, like all of my uncles did. All of them served either in Germany or Pacific, elsewhere in Europe. Some of them died. A lot of them came back. A lot of them buried with, you know, medals and American flag on the coffin. Pretty much all of them hated war. But, you know, in that generation, if you came out of World War II as a veteran, you now had the GI Bill. You could now go to college. So after the war, he ends up going to Columbia University in New York on the GI Bill. And he got his degree in creative writing. He became a writer, author, did a little bit of television. But mostly it was, he was a freelance writer, journalist, author. He actually published a number of novels. And he would also do things like write textbooks for other people, write government reports for other people. And that was his trade. That's what he did for his whole life until he passed away about 13, 14 years ago at age 86.
Wow. What was his pen name? Did he use his real name, or did he have
his,
a...
His real name was William Krasner, spelled the same way. That was his pen name.
So you had a mother who was a tent evangelist and a father who was on TV sometimes.
Well, he wasn't really on TV. I mean, he produced a little TV.
Oh, he produced TV.
In St. Louis, but the majority of what he did was writing novels and writing, you know, journalism and government reports and other things you get paid for.
Okay.
As you may know, getting paid as a writer is not the easiest damn thing. So it was a struggle for him, but he was also a really talented guy, and he managed to make it through.
The theme that I just picked up, though, is that your parents had an interesting relationship with audience. Like, they both were doing...
Storytelling.
Yeah, too. Storytelling, right. I mean, is that something you picked up as a young person before you got into law? Did you ever tell stories? Did you write at all?
I think you're absolutely right about that. And that tradition actually also goes to my wife's family. It's now being carried out by my own family. I mean, my older son, for example, is in graduate school at the Actors Studio in New York.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, even as kids, when our two boys would hang out with my wife and with me, a lot of what we would do is just storytelling. That was like pretty standard stuff. No, it's true. I guess I never thought about it that way. But I mean, my dad would read stuff at the table at dinner. Like, he'd pull out some book he was reading. He'd read a little bit, talk about this and that. His stories, you know, part of his journalism was actually writing about growing up with his father on what they used to call Commission Row in St. Louis. His father was a house painter. He was a fruit peddler. He would do things like take his old truck and drop the front wheels into the trolley track so he could sleep while they were driving the produce to the market at 4 o'clock in the morning while my dad was sitting on the truck, you know. And these were the kinds of sort of stories that my dad would write for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or for other papers when he was younger. So, yeah, there's a long tradition of telling stories.
At what point did you start considering law? Was that in your undergraduate years? Did you have a calling before that?
Well, good question. So, I mean, I was a Spanish language major in college.
So just, diverse. It's so interesting. You had such diverse interests.
I mean, I just loved the language and literature. And I also realized, one of the few things I actually figured out young, I realized there'd be a lot of people speaking Spanish. Mm-hmm. And that it was a good skill to have. Mm-hmm. So
it came in handy when you were on the campaign trail.
It did, as a matter of fact.
To the immigrants, and some people in the audience were like, oh, okay. Yeah.
Who knew?
It didn't come in handy for Jeb Bush, but...
Yeah, you're right. He tried to use it and it seemed...
I always said that he should have just only spoken in Spanish. He sounded so much better in Spanish than he did in English.
We could do this interview in Spanish. And I do look like Jeb Bush.
Did you print any of your campaign material in Spanish? Was that anything that you did or thought about doing?
There were some people who did. I think it was not done in a central way. It was done by some of the volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did think about doing it. I think we'll probably do more of that in the general because... Okay. Part of the emphasis in the general election is to break the mold on how you run a usual campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, what has been going on forever in ordinary campaigns is you keep banging on the same doors where you have high turnouts of voters, same streets, same neighborhoods. And needless to say, that cycle perpetuates, which is good because we want people to vote. But if you simultaneously ignore neighborhoods where the voting turnout is very low, which in Philadelphia does include a lot of the Latino neighborhoods, if you ignore them cycle after cycle, if you never knock on those doors, then as one person said, you have a neighborhood where politicians don't even go to lie. Right?
That's great.
I mean, if it's a neighborhood where politicians don't even go to lie, they have no respect for the process, they don't register, they don't know where the polling place is, and many of those neighborhoods where people do not participate are the ones that are most affected by the criminal justice system because people who live there are in and out of jail.
Mm.
So, you know, we're trying to do this one differently. We're trying to actually embrace democracy, bring new votes in, something that the traditional Democratic Party, honestly, hasn't wanted all that much.
Yeah. So, Spanish language. So you were interested in reading Spanish literature. I don't know, 100 Years of Solitude. That, I don't know what you read, but how did you transition into law or interested in law?
So, let me see. Good question. So, I come out of college, and I took a year off, wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and, Ronald Reagan had graced us with a dreadful economy, so I ended up doing a lot of things. But the main thing that I did was something I'd done for a long time, construction, carpentry, things of that sort. Somewhere in that process, I get selected to be on a jury, which turns out to be a jury in a death penalty case, and it was this gruesome, high-profile death penalty case in Chester County, which is where I was living at the time, which involved a terrible rape murder of an elderly woman and the house being burned down on top of her. overwhelming evidence. She was the mother of an FBI agent, and that agent flooded the area with other agents, and they actually caught the defendant within 24 hours. He was in a nearby hotel. Her blood was everywhere, including his fingerprints in her blood on the glass of her stolen car parked in the motel. So it was, I mean, the case on guilt was very strong. But to make a long story short, I ended up on that jury and I saw the frailties. I mean, I saw how kind of amazing and wonderful court was, but I also saw how very frail it was. I mean, for example, one of our jurors was so mentally ill that he had to be removed from the jury during deliberations. For another example, we had people in the jury room who were using explicitly racist terminology to talk about the defendant and also to talk about other jurors who disagreed with them on anything. So it was a real lesson in the how wonderful and how terrible this giant brain of 12 people can be in any case, especially in a case where you're asking people to decide whether another person should live or die. And you're asking them to do that, you know, based on their being in a courtroom for a couple days or a couple weeks. They're judging the viability, the importance, the significance of another human life. So that, you know, that had an effect. But I guess the simpler answer here is I was really considering three things. I was thinking about divinity school. I was thinking about law school. I was thinking about possibly being a professor of language. And my brother said to me, you like to fight with people. You've got to be a lawyer. He was not wrong. You just like to argue. You like confrontation. I don't like confrontation. That was his statement. He doesn't like confrontation. The truth is I do. I mean, I kind of like, I don't like violence, but I kind of like a showdown about something that matters to me when I think that a position is right.
Were you ever on the debate team when you were young? Did you ever do anything like that?
I was never on a debate team. I did debate some in junior high school.
Okay.
I was good.
Mm-hmm. How'd you know you were good?
Well, I won a lot.
Okay. Real quick, I just want to know, what was the outcome of that case that you were on the jury for?
So the defendant was found, the outcome was complicated. The outcome was 12 of us went back there to deliberate as required by Pennsylvania law, but they had to take a verdict of 11 because the 12th one was so mentally ill, he had to be removed.
Well, how did he get on the jury in the first place?
That's another fascinating tale. So this was such a high publicity case that they did something very unusual, which is they had a sequestered jury, meaning that we all had to live in a hotel. We could not go home. We had to take our belongings with us. So when they're selecting the jury, they asked him if there was any disability or any medication he needed, and he lied and said no, even though he was taking psychotropic medications. So he was fine for a couple days, but by the time you've been in that hotel 6-7 days without your meds, you know, your crazy comes on, and the crazy came on. And we didn't realize it because he'd been acting normally up to a point, but he started to act more in a more peculiar way right before we started to deliberate. And then by the time we got into the deliberation room, he pulled a little Bible out of his back pocket, which he was holding upside down, and he quote read unquote it, and it, you know, was explaining us to us that he could not judge another man, right? So we sent a note to the judge, removed him from the jury. But what was happening out there is a deal was being cut by the defense lawyer, who could have at that point said mistrial, but the deal that he cut was, we'll take a verdict of 11 and you will not pursue the death penalty after the guilt phase. Right? We didn't know that, so we went ahead and deliberated. We came in with a first degree verdict on murder and on sexual assault offenses, which was, in my view, correct then, correct now. I think the evidence was very clear. But we came out with that, you know, level of dread that we were now going to have to go out and decide whether or not he would live or die. And the judge said, thank you very much, and go home, because the deal had already been cut outside of our view that we would not do a death phase.
At that time in your life, had you been against the death penalty even then?
At that time in my life, my feeling was death penalty didn't sound too good. It sounded like a bad idea, but maybe there were certain special cases.
Okay.
I felt differently after that experience, and I felt much differently after I went to law school and spent a lot of time, a whole lot of time, reading up on the death penalty. I did that mostly as a matter of assignments. I mean, one of our assignments in law school, this is 1987, was that we were going to argue whether or not the death penalty was appropriate for juveniles. Okay. Obviously, we know now the Supreme Court's made a decision that no death for juveniles, and then they made a decision no life without parole for juveniles, at least the way it has been done, right? But those were not settled issues at the time. So I spent a lot of time reading those opinions. I became more and more fascinated with Justice Brennan, who was a strong opponent of the death penalty and wrote one dissent after another in which he explained why. So read the studies, realized how racist it was and how it overwhelmingly went against the poor, and also realized how inaccurate the whole system can be. I mean, for example, I didn't know it then, but I've been opposed to the death penalty for, I would say, a little over 30 years. I mean, it's just a fact that there have been six exonerees from death row. Six. During a period of time when we've only killed one person against his will, and we killed two or three others who basically gave up their appeals and wanted to die. I mean, we got more innocent people coming off death row than we got people coming off death row and being executed. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Now everyone's framed you, particularly in the district attorney's race, as the guy on the far left. Did you feel that way in law school? Do you think that, like, you were, did you basically think that you found out that you were, say, on the far left, or did you already know that going into law school?
I knew that when I had voted, I was voting overwhelmingly for Democrats. I knew as a young person that I admired the young Jerry Brown when he came into office. And for those of you who don't remember, he comes into office as governor of California the first time. He's about in his 30s. He immediately says, I will not use the limousine. And he's driving around in a Volkswagen Rabbit, which was pretty much of a hoopty in those days. And he then says, I'm not going to live in the governor's mansion, and refuses to do it. And then on top of that, he's like dating beautiful movie stars. So what's not to like when you're like a teenage kid, right? So, I mean, in my mind, he was a cool politician. I thought George McGovern was a cool politician because I knew a lot about the Vietnam War. My father was a news junkie. He was on television all the time. I mean, he was a veteran. And so I was sophisticated enough to know what we had in Richard Nixon, which was a guy waging illegal wars and a guy who, frankly, was a little unhinged and who belonged out of office. I was happy when he resigned. I was happy when Watergate took him down. I understood enough to know that. So I didn't really view myself as being far left. I guess I just viewed myself as being a Democrat, being a liberal. I think that's the word that they would have used at that time. You know, law school is a terrible place to meet people because those people are going to become lawyers. And if you spent time around lawyers, you know how bad that can be. I mean, they're not all bad, but oh my. There's some of them who are bad. They tend to be a pretty egocentric bunch, really focused on making a lot of money. Not all of them. I mean, in my law school, we had about 10% who from the beginning had a focus on public interest, on careers that wouldn't pay them nearly as much as they could have made, but that were going to do some good in the world. And no disrespect to the rest of them. I mean, a lot of the rest of that class eventually either went back to become academics and teach, or they spent a lot of those mountains of money they made by donating it to good causes and supporting other things. You know, as I get older, I get a little more sensible about not seeing the world in two dimensions. I think it became clearer and clearer when I was in law school that my values were not the average values of someone in law school.
Yeah. When you were in law school, did you ever think that you would be a Democratic nominee for District Attorney of Philadelphia or any big city for that matter?
No.
Mm-hmm. Why? Because government, being in the government, just seemed like incongruous to your value system at that time?
I wouldn't say that. You know, I came out of law school really wanting to do criminal justice work and be a trial lawyer. That was kind of my focus. Okay. And I was willing to do it on the defense side or the prosecution side as long as it was righteous. I mean, that was my bottom line. So I wasn't really thinking in those terms. I mean, I was thinking much more in maybe the Catholic worker terms of the little way. You're not really aimed so much as at fame as you're aimed at the fascinating life that you have when you represent individuals, help out individuals who are not famous with their situations. I mean, that's kind of where I was coming from. Just that the longer I was in the system, the more I realized what the leadership in the DA's office actually looked like, which was pretty much a train wreck.
Is there anything about Seth Williams' district attorney's office that you were pleased with that might have been a model that you would consider keeping now that you might be taking over? Or do you want to just kind of just bleach the goddamn walls and start over?
Well, he wasn't Lynn Abraham. That's a good start. Because let me tell you something. You want to find the bottom of the barrel.
Wow.
That's where the bottom of the barrel is.
You think she was worse?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
interesting.
Yeah.
Death penalty.
I think in the cynical use of power, the abuse of power, I think her cynical mistreatment and disrespect for judges who tried to be independent and tried to do the right thing with what was before them, I think she is unrivaled.
Wow.
Certainly during my career in Philadelphia, she's unrivaled.
Why do you think she lasted so long?
Well, I mean, one explanation would be that the generation of people who identified strongly with Archie Bunker, and I don't mean his likable side, that generation of people is now aging out. They have either passed away or they're just not voting anymore. I think there's another explanation, which is called millennials. I think there's also just this accumulation of all the years of damage that people like her did, and the reality that poor people, and especially poor people of color, get it, and they are not willing to go for that knuckleheaded law and order message when they know what it really means, which is not law. Right. It's just order, and it's not order that even reduces crime. I mean, it really is just about the cynical use of office, power, and rhetoric to advance politician.
Talking about old school politicians, though, one of the stories that I guess is kind of a legend now is Wilson Good calling you when he was the mayor, and having you go down to the Bellevue protests, right? How did you have that relationship with the first black mayor? How did you come to meet him? How did he come to trust you?
So I didn't have a relationship with him. What happened is I had a relationship with ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, as they used to say. You know, when I was coming out of law school, the woman who became my wife and is my wife now and I were classmates. She was back from the Peace Corps, and we were just south of San Francisco, and we were watching two things. We're watching issues around gay rights, but we were also watching the reality of what was happening with HIV and AIDS, which at that time was accurately called the gay plague. I mean, that's just the truth at that time. And we both wanted to do civil rights work. She wanted to do employment discrimination, which she did. And I wanted to do other civil rights work. So we realized that gay rights and rights around HIV and AIDS were going to be among the most important civil rights issues of our careers. Guess what? We were right. So we come out of law school. I'm a baby public defender in Philadelphia in the county. My wife is working doing employment discrimination work for plaintiffs. And she starts doing a lot of disability work, meaning representing people who are perceived as having disabilities, and that gets her closer and closer to people who are dealing with HIV AIDS issues, but also with issues around LGBTQ, right? They get to know me in almost a social way. This mess happens at the Bellevue, where there are people from ACT UP who are protesting because Ronald Reagan and Bush 1 really didn't care whether you died of AIDS, and they certainly weren't going to put any money into it. So people are rightly protesting nonviolently. They have a casket full of symbolic ashes that are supposed to represent victims of HIV, AIDS. The casket ends up getting knocked on the ground. The ashes fly in the air. The police officers who are there overreact, let me put it that way, and they start hitting people with clubs, drawing blood. They fractured the skull of one of the people there, and the mayor sees what a scandal this is. I mean, also how ridiculous, you know, you're going to swing batons at people who may or may not have HIV. You're going to draw blood, which wasn't there before, and you're going to do that because you actually think that you're going to contract AIDS from ashes that have nothing to do with HIV/AIDS.
That's what triggered the police?
There's little question that is when the police started swinging. So, I mean, I think there was a general realization that police had not been well-informed or well-educated on even the medical issues surrounding this, much less the issues of protest and free speech, and that there should be a meeting both of law enforcement and also of people who believed in free speech and were concerned about these issues. So anyway, Good appoints a blue ribbon panel. ACT UP says Krasner's the guy. He puts me on there, but he puts me on there when I'm a young lawyer. I mean, I'm only two and a half years out of law school. And for me, that was a really formative experience. So I didn't have that relationship with him previously, but it came through my credibility with ACT UP.
During the campaign trail, a lot of people were, you know, accusing, or not accusing, but just saying, you know, Larry Krasner has defended rapists, Larry Krasner has defended X, Y, and Z criminals. What do you say to those people? Or like, what's your response in terms of, say, why you selected certain cases or why you took on certain clients? Do you have any response to those people who say, you know, you represented people who weren't good people?
I did represent people who weren't good people at times. I also represented people who were good people. I don't know what country they're living in, but these are the United States. And the way our system works is it's an adversarial system. What public defenders do is they get paid too little to represent too many poor people in a system that can be very unfair. And while I was a public defender, it was very unfair in Philadelphia. That's what they do. I'm not ashamed of that. It doesn't actually mean I planned those crimes. I did not wear a mask during that bank robbery, I assure you. I consider that to be honorable work, in the same way I consider it to be honorable work for a righteous prosecutor to prosecute people, even though he may at times be wrong. You know, despite best efforts, there may be occasions when a righteous prosecutor has represented a person who turns out to be innocent. That doesn't necessarily mean that that prosecutor has done anything wrong in our adversarial system.
And so that's interesting. I think that kind of gets back to, I've heard you say many times, talking about maybe separating the system from the individuals. Because, I mean, in terms of the adversarial nature of just being a lawyer, prosecution or defense, that's important. But it sounds like, in terms of, say, take the district attorney's office, is how maybe they think about prosecution in a systematic way that is more where your critique lies, it sounds, as opposed to, you know, the individual lawyers who are...
You know, I think the basic principle is a sound one. You hate the sin, not the sinner. You know, it's really not so much about personalities, although people would like to make it about personalities. This is really much more about, is the trial fair? You know, defense lawyers who lie, cheat, and steal are rotten. Prosecutors who lie, cheat, and steal are rotten. Defense lawyers and prosecutors who follow all the rules, observe people's constitutional rights, and try to seek justice consistent with their ethical obligations are doing their job. I mean, that's just how it is. We don't expect any professional, we don't expect any police officer always to make the right decision. God knows, if you've been around the practice of medicine, you know that mistakes are made. But the question is, are there bad results happening in medicine because that doctor is willing to lie to you and do a back operation you don't need to make money? Or was an honest mistake made by a real professional who gets it right almost all the time? I mean, that's really what it's about. And for me, that's the issue. There's nothing dishonorable in seeking justice on the defense side or the prosecution side. It just hasn't been enough justice sought in Philadelphia, in my view.
Are there any cases you look back on in your career that you wish... maybe you didn't take on, or that you, a client that you wish maybe you didn't need to? Or is it all, as you were saying, kind of just part of you being part of this adversarial justice system, and you think it's important regardless?
I mean, that is a great and difficult question.
I know there's been a lot of cases too, so it's not like...
It's been a lot of cases. I mean, it's been more than 10,000 cases.
Wow.
There have been some clients who were just... very, very difficult. There have been some clients who did some things that were terrible. But, you know, there is a reason we have an adversarial process. Even when what is done is terrible, there's still a three-dimensionality to both the incident and to the defendant. And sometimes what you're playing for is simply a proportional, appropriate sentence. It's not to argue innocence. Sometimes what you're playing for is a constitutional right that's been trampled. And the only way that we have to address the trampling of those constitutional rights is to point out that certain evidence should not come in. Because otherwise, you're just going to have law enforcement constantly trampling those rights. So there is almost always a righteous goal, a righteous objective, as long as you can keep it in balance, not lose your moorings, see where you are. There's almost always something righteous to do, even if it's just to try to prevent a death penalty because you're morally opposed to the death penalty in a case where something truly terrible has occurred.
What's all these 10,000 cases you talked about, these were all under Krasner Long LLC, that law firm?
No, it was under my 3 years as a county public defender, couple years as a federal public defender where I did nothing but federal cases for people who were poor. And then it's been another 25 years of cases under my law firms. I mean, I've had a couple partners over the years. My first partner ended up on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and then there have been other partners I worked with as well over those years. But my hands have been all over, I mean, maybe more than 10,000 cases.
What happens to the firm now that you're DA? Is it just going to be your partner taking on? Are they going to get a new partner? What happens now?
It's actually a very complicated situation because, you know, if you think about it for a minute, my partner's placed in a position, and that's Lloyd Long, that's my partner. Mm-hmm. He's placed in a position where he can't really take on a new criminal matter and simultaneously have a partner who's going to prosecute it, right? Mm-hmm. So what we have what we have done is his practice has now been separated from mine, mm-hmm. So that I'm not his partner anymore.
Even so it's not called Krasner Long anymore?
Well, right now it's Krasner & Associates, and what I am doing is I am transferring cases to the right attorneys, really capable, ethical attorneys. I'm transferring open cases to them, both civil and criminal cases, as I step back from that. I won't be going to court anymore as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I won't be trying cases anymore. I won't be actively litigating cases anymore because I need to spend my time focusing on the best practices around the country, policy changes, and other things so that I can, assuming I win, which I hope I will, so that I can have a successful transition.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One more question, too, about the St. Louis piece, and I wanted to mention it when Mark was talking about the St. Louis piece, but now that we're kind of talking about politics and DA, when Ferguson happened and you read the DOJ's report about Ferguson and what was happening there, did that surprise you? Or did you kind of have an idea growing up in that area that this was the context in which people lived?
It did not surprise me.
Okay.
Even when I was young, my recollection of Missouri is that it's not too different than Pennsylvania in some ways. You have you certainly have urban centers that are not that different than Philadelphia, but you have areas of the Ozarks, you have areas of southern Missouri that are really the South. And, you know, I don't say that out of any disrespect toward the South, but you have parts of Missouri that were very much you know, coming out of the tradition of slavery and coming out of a tradition of Jim Crow. And when I would visit Missouri, which I did on occasion over the years, you could feel that. I mean, you go to certain places that are not in the middle of St. Louis or in the middle of another large city there, and you realize pretty quickly this is not too different than Alabama.
So you brought up your wife. I know you met in law school. She's now a judge in Philadelphia. Do you guys talk about law at home, or do you try to avoid it? Do you have any like rules about that? I didn't know if you maybe not rules, but do you have any standards in trying to keep, you know, legal discussions out of the house, or is it just kind of free flowing?
Well, we certainly talk about law. We've always been interested in law.
I guess that's inevitable.
We don't. I mean, we really don't give any advice on each other's cases. We don't engage at that level, and as a judge, she's prohibited from participating in politics.
I didn't mean to apply anything like that.
No, yeah. I don't think you did. But I mean, it creates the kind of a silly situation where all my neighbors have a lawn sign that says Krasner for DA, but we don't because she's not allowed to participate in politics. So there are limits, and we observe all That's those great. Limits, but they don't stop us from.
I heard she didn't even come to the election night party.
She is not permitted. This is how deep it gets. Mm-hmm. All right. She asked for an ethical opinion, which is the best practice, from the Board of Ethics that applies to lawyers and judges. And they said the following: you can go to the party at the general election mm-hmm. after the polls close, because at that point, the election will be over. Mm-hmm. But you cannot go to the party at the primary because the election will not be over. Wow. Maybe if your husband loses the primary, you can go over after the poll closes. But if he wins, you can't go. So she didn't. Wow. She takes her ethics very, very seriously, and so do I.
Was she in favor of you running for DA, or was there kind of a real conversation of, well, you know, this is going to really change our life, and you want you to really think about it, or was she your biggest fan and biggest supporter?
Well, knowing me well, she couldn't possibly be my biggest fan and biggest supporter. but I will say this, she supported me, you know, strongly.
So talking about the job that you may be stepping into come next year, assuming the November election turns in your favor, there's going to be a lot of things that I would think, as a defense attorney, maybe you previously railed against or previously questioned, such as, I don't know, confidential informants, things like to that effect, that you might now have to use, maybe as in the district attorney's office. I was wondering, for example, with confidential informants, like, is that something
if you can speak to it at this time, is that a practice that you think you want to reform? Is that a practice that you think that you will not be using as a district attorney?
Well, confidential informant, you know, I'm very familiar with confidential informants. In fact, some years ago, I litigated a civil rights case that involved a non-existent confidential informant.
I always hear these stories, yeah.
By the name of, well, I mean, how do you name someone who doesn't exist? But by the nickname of Happy Jose. Mm. And essentially what occurred there is the feds overturned a conviction they had achieved when it came to their view that the informant who had been the basis for a warrant really never existed, and that what happened is certain narcotics officers had invented this non-existent informant, and then they would keep writing new warrants that referenced how reliable this non-existent informant was. Just look at the prior warrants we got from him. Well, during that litigation, we took a close look at this non-existent informant, and the police insisted that the informant existed. And what we found out is that this informant was not registered, and there is a process for registering informants, received no compensation, and many of them do receive compensation. And what seems to have been central to gangs that were Latino, gangs that were black, gangs that were white, gangs that were selling every different kind of drug under the sun in every different neighborhood in the city, and that this informant sometimes was in the stash house for all these three different organizations in the same week. For whatever reason, this informant was never arrested. This informant was never working off a sentence. This informant just liked to be in the middle of profitable drug organizations and take them down, right? Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's ridiculous. So that's the kind of an experience that you have as an outsider that guides you on how there are certain reforms that you can bring. No, I don't think you should eliminate confidential informants. They do now and have in the past played a legitimate role. But there are ways to get your arms around it so they're not phony. Mm-hmm. They're not lying. They're not non-existent. And, you know, Brady requirements, meaning constitutional requirements that you turn over information that is favorable to the defense, apply to confidential informants as well. So there are safeguards. I mean, it's the same issue when you have jailhouse snitches. You know, you have jailhouse informants. Sometimes they really did hear a confession from a cellmate. Sometimes they really didn't, and they're just reading the newspaper, and they're calling in, and they're trying to work off a sentence. Well, right now we have a DA's office where they're not going to inform you.
Right.
If they have the same guy testifying to a confession in one case from the jail, and a confession in a completely different case from the jail, and a confession in a third case from the jail. That's information that should be turned over to the defense. I've had to go get it myself. Mm-hmm. But we have that type of a system now where there's an effort to not collect information that in fairness ought to be provided to the defense, and not to have these safeguards because, you know, certain prosecutors found it convenient to have a jailhouse snitch in a weak case.
So let's see if we can break a little news here. There's been some reporting this week on Philly.com about Joe Kahn wanting to be your first deputy when you become district attorney, if you become district attorney. People say that he was the progressive who would have been you had you not been in the race. Are you considering him as your first deputy? Have you guys had those conversations?
We will not be making any personnel decisions until after November the 8th. You know, part of what comes with being a change candidate, and, you know, this campaign really, truly is about ideas. It always was. It's not about personality. Part of what comes with that, if you're going to go in and make real profound cultural changes, you need to come in with a mandate. I am not presuming to be the next DA. I am not assuming that this fight is over. My entire career has been spent fighting as an outsider, you know, with my fingernails. I don't think I have tanks and planes. Mm-hmm. I'll have tanks and planes after November the 8th. Mm-hmm. But that would be the point when, with a mandate, real change can be made. So we are not going to make decisions about an office for which I've not been elected at this time.
Well, let me just ask you this in a follow-up. I've had a conversation with Keir Bradford Gray, who of course is the chief public defender, and we've been having this conversation ongoing about the racial disparities in marijuana arrest. Right? I mean, what can be done from the DA's office on that? I mean, of course, this is the police department that's doing those arrests. You can, of course, decline to prosecute. But beyond that, is there any kind of work that could be done with the Public Defenders Association, with the mayor's office, to try and bring this under control?
The answer is yes. Okay. I mean, first of all, you can stop making dumbass marijuana possession arrests. Mm-hmm.
In general, just stop arresting
people. I mean, the city got a long way there by shifting to a system where they just make money and give you a traffic ticket, essentially. I mean, it's not traffic, but same type of thing. But what they don't talk about is they're still prosecuting about 600 people a year for mere possession of marijuana because those arrests are made at a time when there's a seller out there on the street. And they're living in this like fictional world where you're going to turn some marijuana buyer against a street marijuana seller. It never happens. Nobody cares. I mean, it's just dumb. You're just treating those 600 people differently for no reason. So that's one thing that you can do, which I think what you're getting at most basically, though, is the reality that if you're a kid on Penn campus, the campus police are going to protect your probably privileged butt in a way that is the exact opposite of what's going to happen as soon as you get beyond that perimeter, which is that they're going to hassle every young male.
So why do we tiptoe around it and not call it racism? I mean, the police commissioner says he doesn't know why these racial disparities exist. It's unexplained racial differences. Maybe it's cultural. Why do we tiptoe around this?
I don't. I mean, we're talking about racism. We're talking about a decision on the part of the police department that they're going to have scores of contacts with young people in certain communities, but they won't have those contacts in Chestnut Hill. Even though we all know that a lot of the white kids are walking around Chestnut Hill with weed in their back pocket. That's just the reality. You've created a situation in which there is enforcement that's so disparate that you are going to have these very, very frequent contacts. It has a lot of consequences. It's going to dirty up people's records. It's going to make them harder for them to go to college, get jobs, things like that. You're also going to have, unfortunately, these extremely aggressive and hostile contacts between young men and police in certain areas, which are going to be, without question, racist in their result. And then you're going to have more people of color getting killed as a result, because mistakes are made when you stop people unnecessarily over and over and over and over in a hostile context. I mean, we don't need to talk about the names of specific cases for you to be aware. I think almost anybody who pays attention to the news is aware that this is a problem. So, I've never disputed that there is an aspect to this that is racist, because it is.
All right, so I'll wrap up just with one really quick question. Is how are you satisfied with the Tesla? How does it drive? Are you happy with it? Are you looking for another model? Give us a little bit. I've never driven one, so I really want to know.
So there's two important pieces of information I have for you.
Okay. Number
one, I did drive the Tesla here.
Okay. I thought you were going to say it was gone. I was going to say.
I did not. News. I do not have a driver at this time. I do not have a driver, but I don't need it because I have a Tesla. So that's point one. It is in my mind, a modern American car for a modern American district attorney. And
this will be the first DM endorsed by Tesla.
I love it.
Made in Fremont, California. Mm-hmm. I have my own connections to California, including my son living out there, mm-hmm. and my having lived out there while I was in law school. So I think it's a modern American car for a modern American DA. That's point one. But the other thing you need to know is that I wore my favorite socks today.
Oh, I did not notice. I'm a sock guy too. I'm always a big fan of socks.
Well, I bet you I have better socks than you.
But Chris
do. You always have really great socks.
It's like, of course, in the day.
What are your socks? Describe the socks to your listeners.
My socks are a Tribe Called Quest socks.
Wow.
Yes.
That's amazing.
And they feature photographs of all the members of a Tribe Called Quest.
That's amazing.
And it also says
Fife Dog and
a Tribe Called Quest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Fife Dog right there.
So I think it's okay to be DA and be a little different. I love sports. Sports are great. That's great. We've had sports DAs. We'll have more of them. But I think I'll be more like a music DA.
What do you mean a music DA? You're into music?
I'm into music.
Like what kind of music?
A lot of kinds of music.
Yeah, sure. Like hip hop, gospel, blues.
I like.
Do you sing? Do you play an instrument?
I'm the worst singer alive.
Okay. He did the famous video.
Yes, right, which is further proof I'm the worst singer alive. But I like a lot of kinds of music. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of music I listen to. I don't do as well with classical because I was also the worst cellist alive when I was younger. But even then, there's some classical music I like.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, the music lover Krasner, we really appreciate it. In all seriousness, this was a really great interview. I definitely learned a lot about you, and we really appreciate your candidness and coming in here and sharing it with us.
Good luck on November 7th.
November 7th. Don't forget to vote.
What's your button? Is it still 57?
We don't have a button yet.
Okay, right.
They give us numbers later.
Okay.
So.
Well, good luck, man.
Well, thank you.
You ran a great campaign, and looking forward to the next one.
Great talking to you. Real pleasure. Right.
If Krasner wins in November, he might be, at least in my lifetime, the coolest DA. Tribe Called Quest socks, Tesla car, really into music. What do you think?
I mean, I think that might be true. The bar is low. Granted, I mean, we got a DA in jail.
That's so shitty.
Lynne Ram. Is that too much?
No, that's funny though. Keep going. That was funny.
But yeah, I mean, he actually sold me on Tesla, as well as his legal career. But he was surprisingly candid. Yeah. I should say, maybe not surprisingly. I'm just not used to. And I guess this is genuine to how he presented himself in terms of being the outsider, right, and not wanting to run for higher office, not aspiring to. Mm-hmm. He didn't interact with us like a politician, so I appreciate
that. He didn't or didn't?
Did not.
Yeah.
And I also just thought it was cool. I mean, maybe it's just because, like, you know, his dad was a journalist and a writer, and I just found that very interesting, actually.
Was that the most fascinating thing you learned about?
Yeah, I mean, selfishly, I thought that was just really cool. But, I mean, I think that was interesting just to hear it from him. Honestly, that almost origin story of him being on that jury, and that really...
The catalyst, right?
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. And it's also, I didn't follow up. I mean, it's interesting to think that. I know, like, jury trials are less and less common now, and I know, like, most people don't actually get a chance to sit on one. I found that really fascinating. I honestly thought that he was going to say, you know, some incident of witnessing, you know, injustice as a young man or something.
Are you surprised that all the Krasner coverage that you've read, including the New York Times profile, that you've never heard of that tidbit of information?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't know really much at all besides a few lines of his bio that were on his website. I mean, I definitely did my fair share of research and, you know, who he was and how he came to be, besides just over the last, you know, decades of his legal career, who he was before that and came to be, I've never heard before. And I thought that was both really genuine and also, how should I say it? I don't know, just enlightening to think that he didn't have this all figured out. This doesn't seem to be some part of master plan, even just in terms of pursuing law.
Did you get from him that he may want to pursue higher political ambitions?
We should have asked that, but there's too many Tesla questions. I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think
so. He's not going to be mayor one day, you think?
I don't think so. Yeah.
We never know.
This
is Philadelphia.
You know Krasner probably. You've spoken to him and interviewed him more than I have. Mm-hmm. What stood out to you?
The fact that he considered being a preacher before he went to law school, right? Yeah. He said he was going to go to divinity school, and that was his first choice. But that his friend persuaded him the fact, you know, he wanted to debate. And the relationship that he's now having to have with both his wife and his former partner, right? His entire life has really changed from this election and in ways that I don't think the average voter realizes, like all the complexities and in my opinion, it seems that he's doing or at least is more conscious about the potential conflict of interest in our president, which is saying a lot, right? I mean, he talked about separating his business from his partner, not having his wife at his party. I think when you are coming off of the tale of a district attorney who's in jail for being unethical, and then you have a guy going in who won't even let his wife come to the party because he doesn't want to give a conflict of interest, I think we might be on a good track. I think the public should have a reason to be hopeful.
Yeah, and I think it also just goes to show that if you are an outsider, you're probably under more of a microscope. You know, you have to probably be more careful ethics-wise. Because
you don't have the political friends, right?
Exactly. I mean, a lot of people have said it, and I didn't get a chance to ask this, but a lot of people were saying, you know, like, he doesn't have friends in City Hall necessarily. Mm-hmm. At least that's what people are projecting. So it's, you know, I think you got to be a lot more careful, and he obviously has, and at the same time was really candid. So
I think when he gets in there and he shows people that personal side and not just, I'm the guy who sued the city 75 times, I think people will warm up to him. You know what I mean?
Anyways.
So if you like what you heard about Larry Krasner, vote November 7th. This November 7th, you can vote for Larry Krasner or you can vote for Beth Grossman. It's up to you. But we want to thank you so much for downloading Pushback. If you like this episode, please share it with your friends and subscribe on iTunes. Follow Philly Mag on Twitter at Philly Mag. Follow Word Radio on Twitter on Word. Malcolm Burnley, what's your Twitter handle?
At Malcolm Burnley.
And of course, you can check me out on Twitter at Flood the Drummer. And so for Malcolm Burnley, I'm Flood the Drummer, and I'm drumming for justice.